Russia slams the U.S. for accusing Vladimir Putin of war crimes. It says Washington has no right to do so because of its own wars across the globe. The Bank of England says the annual inflation in the U.K. could top 8% this year, the highest in decades, this as the war in Ukraine leaves its economic impact. And Iran says it's finally received the money it owed from Britain after over 40 years of intense negotiations and despite London's obstructions. Hello everyone, welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behzad Shafiq. Good to have you with us. Now, starting with Ukraine, on day 22 of Russian offensive in Ukraine, major cities are the scene of clashes with dozens of casualties reported by Ukrainian officials. Heavy fighting is underway near the capital, Kiev. One person was killed and several people were wounded after a missile hit a residential building there. In a town near the eastern city of Kharkiv, local officials said artillery fire killed some 20 people and injured more than two dozen others. Several Ukrainian cities, including Sumy and Mariupol, are still under siege. Moscow has dismissed as a lie Kiev's accusation that Russian forces bombed a theater in Mariupol where hundreds of civilians were sheltering. Moscow says its armed forces do not bomb cities and towns. It began the military operation in Ukraine on the 24th of February. The two sides have held several rounds of talks and a ceasefire without a major breakthrough. The Kremlin slams U.S. President Joe Biden for calling his Russian counterpart a war criminal. Moscow says the White House has no right to lecture Russia in light of the U.S. involvement in so many conflicts on the planet. Russia had earlier denounced Biden's allegation against President Putin as unforgivable rhetoric. Western governments have ramped up pressure on Russia for its military offensive in Ukraine, but Moscow justifies its campaign, saying that Kiev and NATO pose a threat to Russian security. Author and researcher Greg Simons believes that the U.S. is intentionally making personal allegations against Russian president, as it has done so in the past.
That name-calling and using these terms, which the U.S. has done not only against Russia, but has done a similar tactic against China as well. I mean, this distracts. It's not getting the issue. It's not serious, because the point is, what is going to be the result when you start making these accusations? There is going to be no resolution, because this becomes something personal, and I think this is probably the intention. And especially, as is noted, the US has a long history and is not in a position to be lecturing others about morals and ethics in terms of conducting warfare.
China rejects the U.S. allegations that it is not acting in line with a U.N. charter as regards the Russia-Ukraine conflict. It accuses Washington of having a Cold War mentality.
We have noticed that when U.S. Secretary of State Blinken made such a statement, he falsely claimed that China was on the wrong side of history. The relevant remarks by the U.S. are slandering and smearing against China, which fully exposes the Cold War mentality and group confrontational thoughts of the U.S.
Zhao Lijian says that China has always believed in the importance of upholding the sovereignty and territorial integrity of other countries. Those comments came a day after U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken criticized China for not standing strongly against Russia's offensive in Ukraine. Blinken says such a stance contradicts China's commitments as a permanent member of the U.N. Security Council. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman said that such remarks aren't helpful to resolve the Russia-Ukraine conflict, noting that Beijing firmly opposes them. Okay, that was it for Ukraine news. For now, the Bank of England warning inflation rates could reach 8% in the coming months and perhaps even climb higher later in the year. The warning came after a central bank raised interest rates to 0.75%. The Bank of England has been working to contain the rising inflation. It blames the increasing consumer prices on the conflict in Ukraine, saying that any further tightening of monetary policies depends on the circumstances there. Britain was already experiencing a 30-year high inflation prior to Russia's offensive. Rising energy and food prices have been taking a toll on the British households, with average wages falling at the same time. Now, we've asked our Brussels correspondent, Zach Cruz, about the economic impacts of the Ukraine conflict on Britain.
Well, starting with Ukraine, we all remember country after country, leader after leader, Britain one of them, started levying sanctions against Russia, saying publicly that they were going to wean themselves off Russian energy, hence the increase in the price of energy on the global market. We have seen oil prices hit almost $140 a barrel in the past 4 weeks, a result of the decision by the UK and other Western governments to stop importing Russian energy. As for the British households, they have already been grappling with a cost of living crisis, the first in generations in this country. I haven't lived here for long, but those who have will definitely say so. And also the impact that that has had on energy prices. Motorists, people with cars and other vehicles feeling the pinch at the pump, as well as households looking at their energy bills, gas and electric, going through the roof, only getting worse in the coming months.
Well, that was Zach Cruz, our London correspondent. In France, workers take to the streets in several cities, calling on the government to raise wages and pensions in response to soaring inflation. The demonstrations in Paris and cities such as Nice and elsewhere were part of a national day of strike action that were called by main workers' union, the General Confederation of Labor. The union accused the administration of President Macron of stalling wage increases and shrinking the people's spending power. Protesters are also angry at the government's handling of a recent hike in energy prices. A truckers' organization has called for a protest on March 21st, saying that the government's plan to deal with soaring fuel prices is insufficient. The protests were held on the same day that Macron presented his re-election campaign to the press. Now, this month, the world remembered once again how in 2003, Israeli occupation forces bulldozed to death American activist Rachel Corrie of the International Solidarity Movement, who was in Gaza, exposing Israeli crimes. 19 years on, her death continues to inspire pro-Palestine activism around the world. Saeed Puruza reports.
An incredible act of bravery against a ruthless occupation. An activist there to expose Israeli crimes.
I feel like what I'm witnessing here is a very systematic destruction of people's ability to survive. And that is incredibly horrifying.
23-year-old activist Rachel Corrie from Olympia, Washington, crushed to death by an Israeli bulldozer on its way to demolish yet another Palestinian home in a dark corner of Gaza near the border with Egypt. To her family and eyewitnesses, her killing was intentional. That the driver of the bulldozer could not have missed a blonde-haired foreign activist wearing an orange fluorescent jacket. To the Israeli courts, it was merely a regrettable accident. Her case was closed, but the debate over her death caught on. Rachel Corrie became synonymous with solidarity for the Palestinian cause.
Rachel Corrie, as with a number of other people who've borne the brunt of Zionist attacks, are a symbol, aren't they, in the West, for people who have bravely allied themselves with the Palestinian struggle. I suppose that's the truth, that she's a symbol of resistance.
An example of how Rachel Corrie's activism resonates with activists today is how non-Palestinians are calling out Western media for glorifying Ukraine for things that Palestinians have been doing for years.
At a time of continued Palestinian disappointment over several Arab governments normalizing ties with Israel and the Western double standard over the crisis in Ukraine, the legacy of people such as Rachel Corrie acts as a reminder of the decades-long Palestinian struggle for justice. Saeed Puruza, London.
Iran says that the UK's overdue debt to Tehran has been deposited to the Iranian treasury and is not withheld by the Swiss government. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh says that Iran was able to retrieve London's debt after more than 40 years through an intense negotiation process and despite the UK's obstructionism. He said that Tehran managed to reclaim the rights of the honorable people of Iran after decades of unreasonable resistance from Britain. Khatib Zadeh says the debt was related to an incomplete Pahlavi regime tank purchase deal with the UK, and the British government had used political issues as a pretext to avoid repaying. Iran also said earlier that the UK repaying its debt was in no way related to the case of two prisoners who were released on the basis of Islamic leniency and humanitarian considerations. We'll reach out to journalist and commentator Abbas Aslani for his take on that issue, and he believes that British officials and politicians are trying to make political gains by linking the UK's debt payment to the release of the two British-Iranian nationals.
The prisoners issue is related maybe for some like 5 years or so, but the issue of the UK debt to Iran has been for more than four decades. And if I'm somehow precisely, I'm stating the date, it dates back to 43 years ago. And, you know, the amount of money also was discussed in the law court sessions. It was something, you know, happened in the past, but the UK government was not, let's say, paying the debt to Iran. Sometimes they were bringing up the excuse of the United States sanctions, but interestingly, this time they paid the money without reaching an agreement in Vienna. And this indicates that if they were serious in the past, and if they really wanted to do so, they could have paid the money much earlier. And this indicates that the sanctions could not, let's say, be an obstacle to resolution of the issue. But, you know, the British officials and politicians, they somehow try to make a connection of these two unrelated issues, and because they wanted to somehow gain some political benefits and gains out of these, let's say, two different and independent issues, and in order to somehow engage in blame game issue in this regard.
The Islamic Revolution Guards Corps is warning against the presence of Zionist centers in Iraq days after hitting a similar spot in the Kurdistan region. An IRGC spokesman says if Iraq does not get rid of Zionist bases in that country, Iran will act again. Brigadier General Ramazan Sharif says Iran has the right to attack Israeli bases in the region that threaten its security. He said Iran's ambassador to Baghdad has often warned regional authorities about such centers. Sharif says that Israelis have admitted to flying drones into Iran from bases in Erbil, the capital of the Iraqi Kurdistan. Israel has long been blamed for a wide array of anti-Iran measures. Tehran says that the attack on the Israeli center in Erbil was in response to Israeli crimes against the Iranian people. A journalist and political commentator, Mohsen Abbas, explains why Israel runs bases in the Iraqi Kurdistan region.
Well, the big picture one must understand is that the Oded Yinon plan is still very much alive. It's a document that was produced a long while ago, but Greater Israel was its goal. You know, it constitutes the cornerstone of a powerful Zionist political agenda. And it's there within the military even today. It's there within the intelligence system. And even according to the founding father of Zionism, Theodor Herzl, the area of the Jewish state stretches from the Brook of Egypt to the Euphrates. And according to Rabbi Fleischman, the Promised Land extends from the River of Egypt up to the Euphrates, which includes Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, you know, large tracts of these territories. So when you view that reality, what's going on today in Iraq and what's happening there and the presence of Israel is absolutely of no surprise. And their purpose is to, it's multi-purpose really. One is to really create division, to have bases in the region where they can spread their division and their color revolution activities. They can also use these bases as training grounds for the likes of ISIS, which is another a beast which they directly are involved in nurturing along with the Americans.
Saudi Arabia has put four more people to death, bringing to 100 the number of executions since the beginning of the year. Total number of executions was reported by an AFP tally based on official statements. Riyadh is once again under fire for executing a record 81 people in a single day last week. A prominent rights group said it was highly unlikely that the man received fair trials, calling it a brutal show of the Saudi autocratic rule. Meantime, the UN Human Rights Agency has said that some of those executed were sentenced to death following unfair trials or for crimes that did not appear to meet the most serious crimes threshold. A UN-organized pledging conference on Yemen has raised nearly $1.3 billion, and that's less than one-third of the money that the UN says is necessary to prevent a humanitarian catastrophe in the war-torn country. Neither Saudi Arabia nor the UAE, both of which are parties in the war against Yemen, pledge any money at this year's conference. Abdul Latif Al-Washali reports.
A recent UN-organized pledging conference on Yemen raised only $1.3 billion, less than a third what is needed to help millions of poor people in Yemen. That's despite the fact that the humanitarian situation in Yemen is getting worse day by day.
The so-called pledging conference held by the United Nations is meant to attract funding for United Nations programs and not to save the lives of Yemenis. Unfortunately, the coalition has recently tightened the siege in an attempt to achieve what they couldn't get in their military operation in Yemen. This will only cause a surge in cases of malnutrition and other diseases.
Saudi Arabia, the UAE and Qatar pledged no aid on Yemen this year. Riyadh's representative said Saudi Arabia has in recent years provided Yemenis with over $19 billion in aid. Observers say Saudi Arabia is deliberately deepening what the UN calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Members of the Saudi-led coalition refused to offer any financial grants to Yemen at the recent pledging conference, saying that they had already extended much aid. This shows that these countries insist on pushing Yemen deeper into a humanitarian crisis that the United Nations describes as the worst in the world. The Saudi-led coalition is tightening the noose on Yemenis by tightening the blockade and preventing Yemen from importing fuel, so they are the key players in creating this forgotten tragedy.
The drive on Yemen fell short of its goal as the number of needy people in Yemen has risen from 20 million in the last year to 23 million now. Funding shortages have already forced aid agencies to downsize life-saving assistance programs. To make matters worse, funding for the humanitarian response in Yemen gets smaller and smaller. The failure of the UN pledging conference poses a real threat to lives of millions of Yemenis who rely solely on humanitarian aid to survive. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Congratulations to everyone on the 15th of Sha'ban, the birthday anniversary of the Imam of the Age, Abu Saleh al-Mahdi. May God hasten his reappearance. Hereby, at IRIB English Radio, congratulate all Muslims on the occasion of 15th of Sha'ban, the birthday anniversary of the 12th Imam, Al-Qa'im al-Mahdi. May God hasten his reappearance.
In the limelight.
NASA insists American astronaut Mark Vanderhei's homecoming at the end of the month remains unchanged, even as recent tensions and developments in Ukraine has resulted in cancelled launches, broken contracts, and an escalating war of words between the leaders of the United States and Russian space agencies. We've prepared for you an article written by staff writers of the Associated Press news agency in Cape Canaveral, Florida, under the heading, U.S. Astronauts' Return Hangs in the Balance as Tensions with Russia Escalate. The U.S. astronaut Mark Vanderhei has made it through nearly a year in space, but now faces what could be his trickiest assignment, riding a Russian capsule back to Earth in the midst of deepening tension between the two countries. NASA insists Vanderhei's homecoming at the end of the month remains unchanged, even as recent developments and tensions in Ukraine has resulted in cancelled launches, broken contracts, and an escalating war of words between the leaders of the U.S. and Russian space agencies. Many worry space officials of both countries are putting decades of peaceful partnership at risk, most notably at the International Space Station, the ISS. Mark Vanderhei, who on Tuesday, 15th of March, broke the U.S. single spaceflight record of 340 days, is due to leave with two Russians aboard a Soyuz capsule for touchdown in Kazakhstan on 30th of March. He will have logged 355 days in space. The world record of 438 days belongs to Russia. The retired NASA astronaut Scott Kelly, America's record holder until Tuesday, 15th of March, is among those sparring with the leader of the Russian space agency, Dmitry Rogozin, a longtime ally of Vladimir Putin. Scott Kelly has returned a medal to the Russian embassy in Washington, but believes the two sides can hold it together in space. Scott Kelly said, "We need an example set that the two countries that historically have not been on the most friendly of terms can still work somewhere peacefully. And that somewhere is the International Space Station. That's why we need to fight to keep it." NASA wants to keep the space station running until 2030, as do the European, Japanese and Canadian space agencies. The Russians have not committed beyond the original end date of 2024 or so. The US and Russia are the prime operators of the orbiting outpost, permanently occupied for 21 years. Until SpaceX started launching astronauts in 2020, Americans hitched rides on Russian Soyuz capsules for tens of millions of dollars a seat. The US and Russian space agencies are still working on a system in which a Russian would launch on a SpaceX capsule beginning this fall, and an American would fly on the Soyuz, helping ensure a U.S. and Russian station presence at all times. Mark Vanderhei, a 55-year-old and a retired Army colonel, moved into the International Space Station last April, launching on a Soyuz from Kazakhstan with Pyotr Dubrov and another Russian. He and Dubrov stayed twice as long as usual to accommodate a Russian film crew in October. As the situation 260 miles below intensified last month, Vanderhei acknowledged he was avoiding conversations about Ukraine with Dubrov and Anton Shkaplerov, their Russian commander. Three more Russians will blast off from Kazakhstan on Friday, 18th of March. Mark Vanderhei told an interviewer, "We haven't talked about that too much. I'm not sure we really want to go there." The NASA human spaceflight chief, Kathy Luders, who noted it would be very difficult to go it alone, said, "It would be a sad day for international operations if we can't continue to peacefully operate in space." SpaceX is taking three businessmen and an ex-astronaut escort to the space station at the end of March. In mid-April, SpaceX will deliver four astronauts for NASA before bringing back four on board since November. NASA and SpaceX refused to speculate on whether a seat could be made available for Mark van der Heij. They say a NASA plane and small team will be in Kazakhstan as usual to move him back to Houston, Texas. A former NASA astronaut, Heidemarie Stefanchin Piper, whose father was born in Ukraine, said it was a difficult situation. She said, "We're sanctioning Russia, companies are pulling out of doing business in Russia, but then yet you still have the US government, the space agency, doing business with the Russians." Heidemarie Stefanchin Piper added, "You can't push a button and separate the two sides of the space station." Besides threatening to pull out of the space station and drop it on the US, Europe or elsewhere, Dmitry Rogozin had flags of other countries covered on a Soyuz rocket awaiting liftoff earlier this month. The launch was called off after a customer, London-based OneWeb, refused his demands that the satellites not be used for military purposes and the British government halt financial backing. The European Space Agency is reeling after missing a 2020 launch deadline for its Mars rover, a European-Russian effort. The project was on track for a September liftoff from Kazakhstan. Now it's most likely off until 2024, the next opportunity for Earth and Mars to be properly aligned. Russia has pulled stuff out of the French-run launch site in South America, suspending Soyuz launches of European satellites. All this comes on top of a Russian anti-satellite missile test in November that put the space station's four Americans, two Russians and one German on alert for days. Jeffrey Manber, now with the private Voyage Space Company, helped forge US and Russian ties in the mid-1990s. He sees the space station as one of the final holdouts of collaboration. But, he added, there is no going back if the partnership is ended and the result is a premature ending of the International Space Station program. John Logsdon, Professor Emeritus at George Washington University, expects the end of large-scale space cooperation between Russia and the West. He said, "Russia has been moving towards China already, and the current situation will probably accelerate that move."
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
Dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, and we are here to present yet another episode of A Muslim Lady. If you remember, we have been discussing different issues regarding Muslim Lady. I'm Farman Ali Masumi, and with me in the studio, my wife, Razia Batur Najafi. Assalamu alaikum wa
rahmatullah. Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh. I'm so glad that we are continuing the beautiful subject after a long time.
So you were expanding the hadith of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam, that jihadul mar'i husnut taba'ul. You know, in that time, the men, they would go to the battlefields and they would get so many reward and thawab, the status of shahada and shaheed. And a lot of women, they would complain to the Holy Prophet, why we are deprived from this beautiful, you know, status and this reward. Then Holy Prophet said, Jahadul Mar'i Husnut Taba'ul. If you are to gain the old reward of battlefield, going and doing battle against the non-Muslims and Mushrik and Kafir, and you want to achieve all the high status, then you have to have all these good qualities within yourself in your home. Jahadul Mar'i Husnut Taba'ul.
Yeah, no doubt that her biggest jihad and struggle is at home, and therefore she will get the most reward if she is the winner of this battlefield, you know, because house chore and having a very good relationship with the family members of the house, that is her challenge.
Even
biggest
for
challenge.
The men, that battlefield jihad is jihad asghar, the small jihad.
Beautiful, yeah.
And fighting against their nafs and nafs ammara and all their desires, that is the jihad akbar, the biggest jihad.
Absolutely, absolutely. So when, like many people, especially this is the big question mark in the minds of today's girls and women, that why Lady Fatima, she's saying that this is the best for women, that she sees no men and no men sees her. Why? The biggest question is that she herself, you know, her character, her seerah, is showing us totally in some angle
against it,
you know, because MashaAllah, she was present in Mubahila. Yeah,
despite having short life,
exactly.
You know, few years, but we see her character in different events.
No doubt. Yeah, I love the way she used to go twice a week to the graveyard of martyrs of Uhud, and especially Hazrat Hamza. Yeah, the chief of martyrs of that time, Sayyidul Shuhada of that time, because his position was so high. So she would just easily, she would sit at home and she would recite Quran for martyrs. She would do some matam, majlis, and
lamenting, you know,
exactly.
And giving the reward to those shuhada.
Absolutely. Why all the way? And you know, the graveyard of Uhud wasn't that nearby her house in Medina. You know, she has to walk with Imam Hassan and Hussein, that little
small children.
Boys. So it wasn't easy. And not only once she went there, you know, her presence was regular. Dear listeners, let's have a short break and we will come back very soon.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back to our show of Muslim Lady. And I have seen many ahadith and events that after the demise of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, again she, Lady Fatima Zahra salamullah alaiha, is choosing a public place to sit and to raise her voice against the government. Yeah.
Defending the wilaya of Ali ibn Abi Talib. Even in the life of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, so many companions, they would go to Fatima Zahra.
Yeah.
Rasulullah himself, as you mentioned and we mentioned in our previous programs, they would refer them to the Lady Fatima Zahra.
Today only I was reading that Salman Farsi, he would go sometimes to help her in house chore.
Wow.
He would say, oh, Lady Fatima, you know, because Hassan Hussein or Zainab and Ali Muslim, they are crying and you have to make some bread too. So which area you would love to help? You know, like, shall I help you? Sitting with the kids or making a bread. So she would say, you make a bread because I'm a mother. I'm more closer to my children. I will take care of children, you know. You shouldn't sit as a babysitter and I'm just working. So that is all the beautiful points which we get from her beautiful life. So all these are there. Amazing, amazing. Like Mahmoud bin Lubayd, one of the companion, he is having literally a debate with Lady Fatima Zahra salamullah alayha in Baqi or in graveyard of Uhud. You know, like look at the conversation. Exactly. Not only that, maybe you will be amazed that Lady Fatima, she would go to visit a sick people. At night, she would go to feed an orphan or widows, you know, like ladies. So not only Lady Fatima, Lady Zainab salamullah alayha too, because unfortunately, these things are not that much common. The picture which we have made about Lady Fatima is that just she's most of the time, maybe 99% of her life, she's just at home. And she went out after the demise of Rasulullah, you know, like that kind of picture we have. But how she can say that, you know, you have to take care of your family or Sila Rahim, you know, your relatives, you have to share the grief and the happy occasions of your society. She keeps telling all these ahadith from Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, but if she's not acting upon those ahadith, then she's not a true Muslim, na'uzubillah. Yeah? But definitely. We know that she is very social. She used to attend some wedding, you know, ceremonies. All those social activities were there, and she used to come out if there's a need. So women should be independent. Independent in that sense that if, for example, if I'm a sick, yeah, if I'm going to the doctor, so why should I go to the male doctor?
Yeah, in all the fields, women should have their own specialist.
Exactly.
Means if they want to go to school, they should have their own female teachers, female staff, female school. If they want to go to the doctor, they should have female doctor, female hospital, yeah?
She's not saying that 100%. Yeah, if someone is coming to ask about Wilayat and Imamat, she's replying, yeah? So it doesn't mean that 100%, but she says it's better. It's better. خَيْرٌ لِلنِّسَى. It's better that you should solve your problem yourself.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Why you are always having this expectation from men that you come and solve our problems, you know, you are our leaders all the time? No, you know, in certain areas, as you said, you can have your own, you know, faculties and your own specialist. So you just solve your problems by your own manpower. Yeah, so that is the beautiful message of Lady Fatima, which I love it.
I agree with you, but in all the aspects of life, it is almost impossible. Yeah, some, you know, jobs and some works women cannot do because of their physical ability. So as much as they can
do,
it's better for them to have their own, you know, specialists and their own entertainers. So these ahadith of Holy Lady Fatima Zahra salamullah alayha does not mean that women should always, you know, keep themselves within the boundary of their house, within their house and keep away from all these social activities.
Some of Maharaj, even they say, it's better if you have any talent. Yeah, Allah has given you so many skills and you can solve the problems of your society, but you're just sitting at home because I'm a woman, you know, it's better to sit at home and I'm just, you know, wasting my time because I'm a woman, I shouldn't be very active. This is totally wrong kind of thinking, yeah? The Institute of Lady Fatima al-Zahra never teaches us this kind of mentality that sometimes it's incumbent, it's wajib, it's necessary, compulsory that you have to be
step out
exactly
and go into the society,
be
and
a
play
very,
your role.
Yeah, play your role, be very productive. Yeah. You know,
again, it depends if you are coming out of your house because of the worldly desires to show off your beauty and your style and these, you know, haram things, then it is wajib and it's better for you to stay within your house. But if you are an active member of your society, you have good intention, you have this talent, and you know the boundaries of the rules of Allah and Sharia, then within those boundaries, you should play your role in your society. That's what these ahadith of Fatima al-Zahra salamullah alayha teaches.
And inshallah, I will tell you some amazing, fascinating female sahabi and companions of Rasulullah, that how they were used to work. You know, they would have their own business and they were just following up their career in a society, you know, so that is so amazing.
Our histories are full of those incidents and events where ladies, they have played a very vital role in our societies, in the battlefields, in you know, all those social activities. So which also is a very helpful and useful guideline.
Inshallah,
for
we are
women.
Going to discuss in our next episode. Today's discussion was useful and I'm sure that many of our young girls and our Muslim ladies, they would get amazing answer from the sayings of Lady Fatima al-Zahra, salamullahi alayha. Thank you so much for being with us. Fi amanillah.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Europeans, as longtime allies of the United States who have played a significant role in the Ukraine crisis through their actions and stances, now find themselves facing a large population of Ukrainians. They have to give shelter to the displaced Ukrainians despite domestic economic problems of their own and the coronavirus pandemic. We now present you an article written by an international relations expert, Hassan Shokuhi Nasab. The piece is titled Flood of Ukrainian Refugees, Shadow of Crisis of Century Over EU. Since 24th of February, when Russia launched a special military operation in Ukraine after provocations by the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, the number of displaced people and refugees who have chosen European countries to escape from the crisis has been increasing day by day. According to a report by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, issued recently, over 1.5 million Ukrainians have fled their country. Filippo Grandi described the exodus of this number of war victims as the fastest-growing crisis in Europe since the Second World War. If the crisis continues and the war becomes erosive, the number of refugees leaving the European country of 44 million people is expected to rise to more than 10 million. Of course, some states will be more affected by the flood of refugees due to their geographical proximity to Ukraine. 2 weeks into the conflict, half of the refugees arrived in Poland, followed by Slovakia, Hungary, Romania, and Moldova. This wave will gradually reach Western European countries, but the United States, as the main sponsor of creating and intensifying the crisis in West Asia, is immune from the flood of refugees and its harmful consequences due to its distance from the conflict zone. As a result, the burden of responsibility will fall on the leaders of the European Union. The Europeans, as longtime allies of the United States who have played a significant role in the Ukraine crisis through their actions and stances, now find themselves facing a large population of Ukrainians. They have to give shelter to the displaced Ukrainians despite domestic economic problems of their own and the coronavirus pandemic. Previously, the European Union agreed to grant temporary residence permits to Ukrainian refugees for up to 3 years. To implement this plan, the European Union for the first time activated one of its mechanisms to allow Ukrainian citizens and their families to reside, work, study, and enjoy social welfare within the 27-nation bloc. This immigration policy adopted in the wake of the Ukraine crisis reflects the EU's double standards in dealing with the displaced and refugees. Even European bodies which are monitoring the situation of refugees in European countries are accused of treating quite differently the refugees from Ukraine's war-torn areas and those displaced by wars in elsewhere, such as in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Additionally, the Ukrainian army and government systematically discriminate against those displaced by the war. For example, the African Union said African nationals on the Ukrainian border are treated in a manner shockingly racist and in violation of international laws. On the eve of the third millennium, the West, with its 2001 and 2003 attacks, plunged Afghanistan and Iraq, as well as the entire region, into poverty and insecurity. However, it has, through various means, evaded responsibility for accepting refugees from these countries. In the course of the latest developments in Afghanistan and the rise of the Taliban to power in the crisis-stricken country, which were largely caused by the West, the United States and Europe have resisted international pressure to open up their borders to the displaced and war victims. As the main sponsor of this deplorable situation, the United States received only 30,000 Afghan migrants. Canada also accepted just 20,000 refugees. The European Union member states are facing economic challenges, especially security identity ones, and have rifts in this regard. Some of them refuse to accept refugees despite pressure from EU leaders. Moreover, the share of major EU powers such as Germany, which are considered leaders, did not exceed 10,000 refugees. The European countries have always been referred to as migrant hosting, as opposed to those called migrant first. This is also true at the time of crisis, when the displaced and refugees from across the globe target the Green Continent. Such waves deepened the internal challenges of this unbalanced union and ultimately threatened the dream of European convergence and its subsequent security architecture. Contemporary views in Europe have shifted on the issue of immigration and refugees, viewing it as a security issue that is a major threat. It is widely believed that migrants, the displaced and refugees, jeopardize social cohesion, employment opportunities, welfare systems, religious and cultural integration, democratic values, etc., and thus they're regarded as an obstacle to the stability of the host countries. This creates an atmosphere of scepticism towards migrants and foreigners. In such an atmosphere, Europe has been repeatedly attacked by terrorists, and the ground has been laid for the emergence of and rise of far-right extremist parties in the European continent. The extremist, anti-immigrant, racist, and militant groups seek to link all crises to refugees and increase their own political popularity, as well as their supporters, by means of intimidation against the dire consequences of hosting migrants. According to some opinion polls, far-right groups have been welcomed by some European people in recent years, something that has resulted in their growing share in the parliaments and governments of various EU countries. It is mainly due to two factors. First, the high number of migrants and refugees, and second, the deteriorating economic and welfare conditions of European citizens caused by financial crises and the coronavirus outbreak. These issues led to extremist parties manoeuvring in the European Union, like the efforts of 16 right-wing parties to form a new alliance in the 705-member European Parliament. Back in July, the right-wing parties in the European Parliament, including those from Hungary, Poland, France, Spain and Austria, announced that they were trying to set up a front to reform Europe. Alarm bells are ringing on growing extremism and the dire consequences of the rise of extremist outfits in Europe. In January, European Union counter-terrorism coordinator Ilkka Salmi warned against the escalation of violent right-wing extremism in the European continent. Salmi named as European terror threats the aforesaid phenomena, along with the tendency of some citizens to active extremist groups, as well as cyber-terrorism. This situation will undoubtedly worsen if millions of Ukrainian refugees enter the European Union. Recently, the leader of Spain's far-right Vox Party has welcomed the absorption of Ukrainians fleeing their country. In an address to the parliament recently, the leader of Spain's far-right Vox Party, Santiago Abascal, said the Ukrainian refugees must be welcomed by the European countries because they are indeed war refugees, but described Muslims who are fleeing their crisis-hit countries as invaders. He said anyone can tell the difference between them, meaning Ukrainian refugees, and the invasion of young military-aged men of Muslim origin who have assaulted European borders in an attempt to destabilize and colonize it. The far-right Vox Party in Spain has repeatedly been slammed for its Islamophobic stance. The Ukrainian crisis put the racist European policy against non-Europeans under spotlight, with Bulgaria, which has been against hosting refugees from West Asia, also opening its doors to the Ukrainians. Bulgarian Prime Minister Kirill Petkov said, "These are not the refugees we're used to. These people are Europeans." Petkov added, "These people are intelligent. They are educated people." The United Nations refugee chief also admitted that some non-European refugees have faced discrimination while attempting to flee to safety at Ukraine's borders. Following Moscow's military operation, which was launched on 25th of February with the aim of demilitarizing and denazifying Ukraine. Filippo Grandi confirmed there has been a different treatment by Ukrainian security forces and border officials at a press conference recently, and a number of black, South African and Mediterranean refugees shared accounts of being blocked at borders while trying to make crossings.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.